In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. Setting sail in the year 1860, the Clotilda was the last ship to transport enslaved people from Africa to America. In her new book, Survivors, A History of the Last Captives of the Atlantic Slave Trade, Hannah Durkin has traced the lost stories of the final people to be transported on the ship and explores what their experiences can tell us about the slave trade in general. David Musgrove spoke to Hannah to find out more.
So, abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire took place in 1807, and the same year, the Act prohibiting importation of slaves was passed in the States. And yet, the ship, the Clotilda, brought slaves to America from Africa in 1860. So that is half a century after that fact. Clearly, the slave trade had not ended. Can you give us a little sense of how that came about?
Yeah, so as you say, slavery is legally abolished in the British Empire and in the United States. The United States declares the trade piracy in 1820, which means it's a capital crime, so you can be executed for participating in it. But the trade never stops. It mostly centres on Brazil and Cuba, certainly Cuba by the 1850s. And a lot of the ships that are sailing across the Atlantic and enslaving people, trafficking them across the Atlantic, are US-built ships because Britain, which is the lead police force patrolling the West African coast and trying to prevent the trafficking of human beings, basically can't really search ships with US flags because it's an old military enemy. It's the only empire that doesn't dare confront, really. So there's actually more than a quarter of all Africans shipped across the Atlantic are shipped after 1808. So we're talking 3.2 million people out of 12.5 million people in total who are sent across the Atlantic.
So that's very grim statistics. And so clearly the trade was continuing. And in the States as well, the institution of slavery, what was the position of slavery as a concept in the United States in the first half of the 19th century?
So slavery grows because of the growth of the cotton industry. So what happens is, I mean, the United States is expanding as well, of course, in the early 19th century. So states like Alabama are joining in about 1818. And there's all this what, quote unquote, new land. Of course, it's not new land because native peoples were there beforehand. But Europeans are claiming this land and then, you know, basically going there to create cotton estates and, of course, to grow the cotton industry. They need workers and they need enslaved workers. I mean, the cotton industry itself, it's a minor crop in 1760. And then by 1860, it's when the Clotilda sails across the Atlantic. It's the, you know, it's the 19th century world's chief global commodity. So this is how much it grows in the early 19th century.
So there was a clear reason and economic need for people to want to continue to get enslaved people to work in these cotton plantations. That we talked about the fact that the slave trade was technically illegal during this period. So how difficult was it for the people who were getting these ships and going to Africa and coming back to America? How difficult was it for them to carry out that trade? How far were the authorities patrolling and trying to stop it?
So the US anti-slavery patrol is very small up until the eve of the Civil War. So it's mostly the British Empire that's patrolling and trying to stop this trafficking enterprise. But of course, because Britain doesn't dare search US ships and the US isn't allowing them to search their ships, it means that it's quite easy, unfortunately, for traffickers to sail across the Atlantic and then sail back to, you know, as I said, mostly to Cuba by the 1850s. So, in fact, more than 70%, 70% of all Africans who are taken to Cuba are taken after 1820. And we're talking about more than 500,000 people here. So this is how many and how many people of African descent in Cuba were, their ancestors were victims of the illegal trade.
Let's talk about this ship, the Clotilda, then, which is kind of the key bit of your excellent book. So this ship sails in 1860, which is, as you said, right before the American Civil War. What can you tell us about this ship? Who paid for it? Who captained it? Who sailed it?
So the Enterprise, if that's the right word for such a crime, was led by a man named Timothy Mayer and his two brothers, James and Burns. These were men from Maine, so in New England, who'd relocated to Alabama and were shipbuilders. So they're the people who lead the Enterprise. But also the captain was a Canadian man named William Foster, the captain of the ship, and also quite significant, powerful men in Alabama were certainly involved in the Enterprise and were Clotilda enslavers. And but what seems to have happened is that, I mean, it was sparked by a bet. I mean, it was long rumoured that a bet had sparked this crime, but and I was quite surprised to find evidence of the bet when I managed to identify one of the witnesses to the bet when I came across a note in an archive. But it's also part of a wider attempt to reopen the US slave trade on the eve of the Civil War. So given the people who were involved were also closely connected with radicals who were pushing for secession, the southern states to secede from the Union, and they're also calling very openly for the US slave trade to be reopened. And that's because, I mean, it's mostly because they need workers to work the cotton estates, but also because enslavers in the Deep South are having to basically buy enslaved people from the Upper South, and that's very expensive. It's actually cheaper, quite horribly, to purchase African people, maybe $60 to $100, as opposed to buying them from the Upper South for maybe $1,000. So the financial motive is very strong. But basically, so what happens, and of course, these men are also aware that the Cuban slave trade is happening. So they want to expand it to the US South. And so Timothy Mayer launches this crime, and the Clotilda sails across the Atlantic, as you say, in 1860, so just a year before the Civil War. And it lands in the port of Ouidah in present-day Benin, and traffics 110 people. And these 110 people, half a male, half a female, but most of them are children or very, very young people. And that was typical, unfortunately, during the illegal trade. So nearly half of people trafficked after 1810 were under the age of 15. So this is many of the victims of the illegal trade were children.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, so this is where the story gets very dark and grim. So tell us what we know about the story of the people who ended up on the slave ship. Where did they come from and how did they come to be captured and enslaved?
So the young people, or children and young people who were trafficked on the Clotilda were from a town in present-day southwest Nigeria. So it appears that almost all of them were from that same town, and their town was destroyed. So their community was at war with the Kingdom of Dahomey, which was then kind of the major empire on the West African coast. It's a slave trading empire. It grows probably because of the transatlantic slave trade. What happens is this town is attacked very early in the morning. A lot of people are killed. They are elderly and, you know, are killed. And men, most of the men appear to have been killed. and the survivors are then forced to march to the coast, this 250-mile walk to the coast. And then what happens, of course, is they're held at the coast for 3 weeks. And then the Clotilda's captain, William Foster, comes along and buys them. He buys 125, but because this is an illegal voyage, he has to rush to get them on board the ship before anti-slavery patrols arrive. So 15 of them are actually left behind on the coast.
So who are the attackers? Who got them from their hometown to the coast?
So this is King Glele of Dahomey and his army, so of men and women warriors who are at war with what used to be the Oyo Empire, but I mean, the Oyo Empire has collapsed by 1860. The town is sort of part of what would have once been the Oyo Empire. So the kingdom of Dahomey appears to have been, according to all the records, I mean, it's also worth noting that former members of the Oyo Empire were at war with one another as well. So this is how dangerous it was for towns and villages in the 19th century, how many civil wars were at play, as well as the war with Dahomey.
What did the attackers want? Was it just they wanted the financial benefit of selling these people, or was it part of a broader process of conquest?
Yeah, it's part of a broader process of conquest. So King Glele is at war with Abeokuta, which is not too far away from the town where the Clotilda survivors are from. He never manages to conquer that city. But also he is reliant upon the money that he can make from selling people to fund his empire. Unfortunately, this is a military state, so it's reliant on warfare rather than agriculture. And unfortunately, it's selling people to fund the empire. As King Glele says himself, when the British try to make him stop, they try to make them turn to palm oil instead. And he does for a while. But he does say in reply that, you know, I paraphrase a bit, but he says that, what will my people do? You know, or at least I can't stop at once. What will my people do? And besides this, I would be in danger of losing my life. So he's in a situation where if he gives up his slave trading empire, then he himself and Dahomey is at risk of then the same thing happening to them. So they could then be enslaved and sold across the Atlantic.
So let's talk about the unfortunate captives. So you said they were captured and there was a horrific attack and all manner of violence exhibited there. And then they were force marched, what do you say, 250 miles to the coast. And then they are contained in hellish environments in things called barracoons. What happens to them there?
So barracoons are basically they're prisons on the coast. So they're what's also known as slave pens. And these are really horrible confined spaces, very poorly ventilated spaces, where people are only allowed out once or twice a day to exercise and fed once or twice a day. And the conditions inside the barracoon are so poor that some people who would have been sold across the Atlantic, they actually don't survive. Because what happens during the illegal slave trade is that people are held in these barracoons for quite a while enslavers wait for a slave ship to sneak across the Atlantic and then, you know, then for them to be bought and sold. So the conditions in the barracoon are horrific, but the fact that they're held in there for quite a length of time, because they're not sold straight away, they're only sold when they can be smuggled, you know, across to the slave ships, it means that not everyone who is held in there survives that experience.
Okay, so the slave ship arrives and the captain gets off and presumably has to do a deal with somebody to purchase the human cargo.
Yes, it takes him 8 days to actually secure a deal. And in that time, he's worried that he himself will be enslaved. So he's quite frightened when he does that. But of course, he does secure a deal. So he brings quite a lot of gold and also other, you know, fine material that, you know, cotton and, you know, items to trade. So he's in a very good position to buy, unfortunately, 125 people.
And as you said earlier, he gets the people almost to his ship and then he fears that perhaps he's going to be spotted by the authorities. And so he doesn't get all the people he's bought onto the ship, but he does get away with 110 people. And then there is the horrors of the passage across the Atlantic, which are probably reasonably well known. So we won't spend too long talking about that. But one thing that particularly struck me from your book is just it really drove home how horrifically dehumanizing the whole thing was. And you talk about how the enslaved people, their clothes, hairstyle, body ornaments were removed, and how much of a sort of, how much that would have cut to the quick of their identity. Could you perhaps just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so they had everything taken away from them, their clothes. And this was probably for hygiene reasons because of lice infestations, and they wouldn't have been able to wear the same clothes for 45 days. This journey took 45 days. But of course, I mean, how this is such a humiliating experience that they recall the horror of this, the loss of their clothes, of losing everything for decades later. Later on, of course, their names are taken away from them. A lot of them aren't able to hold on to their African names, so they lose that part of their identity. So it's a really dehumanizing experience that really traumatizes them.
Let's skip over the rest of that voyage, horrific though it was, and take the story on to when they arrive in America. So where does the ship end up? Where does it dock?
So it arrives in Mobile Bay, which is the port city of Alabama. And it's basically taken up the Mobile River. And then the Clotilda survivors are taken away and hidden. And the ship itself is then scuttled and burned in the Mobile River.
And was there a need for secrecy here, that the ship owners and the backers couldn't be seen to be engaged in this enterprise?
Absolutely. So this, of course, is a crime in the United States. It's a capital crime. So this is why the ship is burned. And in fact, what seems to have happened is a US marshal actually manages to locate the survivors. Now, not all of the captives survived the journey. The marshal located 103, which suggests that 7 of them probably didn't survive the journey. And there's other evidence to suggest that survivors or captives didn't survive. But this US marshal encounters them, reports it to this southern judge who should have acted, but who was suspiciously away at the time. And so that gives the Mayer brothers time to hide or to move the captives again. And they're never recovered. The Mayer brothers, or at least Burns Mayer, William Foster, and the man whose land they're originally hidden on, they're all indicted. But the crimes are quickly, the trials never happen, basically. They're quickly dropped and they're never prosecuted for the crime.
Would it be fair to say that this was an open secret, that most people knew what was going on and were broadly okay with it happening and just wanted it to be swept under the carpet?
Yes, I mean, it certainly seems the case that local newspapers are reporting on it in quite a coded way, which suggests that their editors knew. And of course, I mean, perhaps we'll come on to this later, but some of the captives are forced to labour on the steamboats in Alabama. So going up the Alabama, the Mobile River and the Alabama River. And they're working, they're labouring on the steamboats to collect firewood along the banks. So they're so visible. And they're so visible that a London Times journalist encounters them a year after they arrive. So this is just how visible they are.
But of course, this was a slave economy, slaveholding economy, and there would have been a lot of slaves in the general vicinity. So the people on the Clotilda, they were fairly quickly dispersed into working for various people in different roles. Do we get a sense about how the newly arrived enslaved people from Africa were treated by the existing enslaved population in this area?
So the existing enslaved population appears very unfortunately to have internalised all these racist ideas about Africa that are being perpetuated to justify slavery, savages, heathens, those kind of attitudes, narratives. And what makes things even worse for the Clotilda survivors is that they're made to feel ashamed of their language, of their body markings that mark them out as Clotilda survivors, of their religious and, cultural practices. So they do attempt to practice their, to gather together on their one day off this Sunday and, dance and have a good time. And to their West African rhythms, they have a drum that they, that they build. But they quickly learn to stop this because they get such a negative reaction from the community around them that it's impossible for them to hold on to those traditions.
So we're approaching the start of the Civil War, so presumably a very febrile atmosphere in and around the whole area. Can you just give us a sense about what happens to maybe just 2 or 3 of the Clotilda survivors, what their lives are like in the years following 1860 and through the Civil War?
Yeah, I'll try to give you 3 examples. So Kazula, who is one of the people who's forced to work on the steamboats, he has a terrible ordeal traveling up the Alabama and Mobile rivers, you know, working into the night, working these incredibly high banks, river banks that he's having to run up and down all the time. And he's every time there's a stop, a landing, he's having to gather firewood. And in fact, one of the Clotilda survivors, Clotilda captives, actually drowns during doing this work. So we know that because of a newspaper article that was an account written 50 years after his death. The person who witnessed it was so struck by the horror of his death and also the devastation of the other Clotilda survivors that he could still recall that death 50 years later. Other captives are sent to work on the cotton fields. So one Clotilda survivor, a woman named Ella Duncan, is actually enslaved right in the heart of Montgomery, which is the capital of the Confederacy, the first capital of the Confederacy. So she is enslaved in a leading man who's very closely connected to leaders of the Confederacy. And he lives just a street or two away from where the Capitol building is. So she must have seen the Confederacy at first hand. She must have seen all the leaders of the Confederacy and the celebrations and this sudden turn to war and to, I guess she's right at the heart of this political scene. So that's quite, I'm sure she didn't understand it, but it's quite incredible just how visible she must have been to the leaders of the Confederacy as well. And Radoshi is sent to work in the cotton fields near Selma, and her circumstances very sadly are very dire as well. So she's working in the cotton fields, and her circumstances don't really change in the decades after her enslavement in the cotton fields. She's still working in the cotton fields up until the 1930s.
At the end of the Civil War, presumably they are freed. They achieve their liberation. Does that happen? What happens to them? And do they try and get back to Africa? Because it hasn't been that long, I guess, since they were forcibly shipped across to America.
For most people, it's nominal freedom. So those who are sent to the cotton fields of central Alabama, their circumstances don't change very much. They're still forced to work as sharecroppers in the cotton fields, and probably only partially aware of any change because they never witnessed the Union Army coming close to them. So they probably weren't very strongly aware that there had been a political change. As for those who were enslaved in Mobile, they do secure nominal freedom, but they're forced to work on the sawmills of their former enslavers. They're forced to menial labour for their former enslavers and hire themselves out. But they attempt, because they are earning a wage, they attempt to save up money to go home. But because quite a few of them have children by this point, so they're quite large families in some cases, it's far too expensive. I mean, they appeal to the Mayer brothers, they appeal to Captain William Foster to take them home because it's by rights they should take them home. But of course they're refused, so they have no help. But what's really sad as well is that a missionary who can speak their language goes to their church because they've converted to Christianity about 1868, 1869. And a missionary encounters them in the church in 1869. And they tell him about how desperate they are to go home. So he leads a campaign to try to get them to go home. But there's no money there. So the American Colonization Society was set up in the early 19th century to repatriate, if that's the right word. But basically to expel would be a more precise word. People of African descent from America. It's really about creating a white nation above all. But it would have been, the American Colonization Society was still running in the 1860s and had just run out of funds in 1869. So if the missionary had encountered them in 1868, there might have been money from the American Colonization Society to send them home.
It does feel very, very tragic that they're kind of, this missionary gives them maybe a sense of false hope that perhaps there's a chance. But they do manage to maintain or recreate some sort of sense of community, don't they? Tell me about Africatown.
Yeah, so the Mobile survivors, they establish what they call African Town. It still exists today as Africa Town. This is a community that they established just north of Mobile, so it's about 3 miles north of Mobile. They save up to buy their own land. So they sacrifice everything, really. They live on subsistence, barely subsisting on molasses and things like that to pay for this land. And this becomes a really prosperous, really significant community in the early 20th century. I mean, this is a community of maybe about 2,000 to 3,000 people. It's a community of Black-owned businesses. And what's really striking as well is the most successful business people in this community are the Clotilda survivors themselves. So Charlie Lewis, who is one of the original leaders of Africatown, they appoint their own leader and judges. So he's one of the first two judges. And he's the most successful businessman in his community until he dies. And then it's Ozzy Akibi, another Clotilda survivor. So they are, yeah, leading figures in the community and a real inspiration to the other members of this township as well.
So quite a diverse range of experiences that the Clotilda survivors experienced, some of them broadly living the same sort of life as they had when they were enslaved and others able to live more fruitful lives, I guess. You mentioned earlier that some of the survivors do live on right into the 20th century, into the 1930s and 1940. So that's kind of quite unique, isn't it, in the sense of the proximity, temporal proximity to now. And I think you've been able to speak to some of their descendants, is that right? And you've got a sense, so I guess you get quite close to their actual testimony of people who were enslaved.
Absolutely. So about maybe 5 years ago now, I contacted the grandson of the last Clotilda survivor, Matilda McCrea. So Matilda McCrea was 2 years old when she was trafficked across the Atlantic with her mother and three sisters. Her two brothers were left behind on the West African coast. And when she arrived in Alabama, her two oldest sisters were sold away from her. So she never saw those sisters again either. So she only ever knew her mother and one of her sisters. But Matilda McCrea's grandson, Johnny Crea, knew throughout his life, I mean, he's in his mid-80s now. He knew throughout his life that his grandmother was African, but it wasn't until I wrote to him that he found out that she was a Clotilda survivor. So when I went to Africatown and I went to Selma as well, he lives in Selma, about a month ago, just over a month ago, just when my book was published in the United States. And I got to spend time with him. I got to spend time with his wife. I met two of his children. And, you know, I met lots of other descendants as well of Matilda McCrea and other Clotilda survivors. And yeah, I think Johnny Crea, unfortunately, doesn't remember his grandmother. He was about 3 years old when she died. But he, obviously, he knew of her. He knew the stories of her. And I think it's just been really fantastic to be able to learn more secondhand in some cases or met ancestors' memories that have been passed down. But also for me to be able to share things I found out about their ancestors as well, where they came from and, you know, what they endured, but also how they survived and how they were such an inspiration to the communities around them.
Before we wrap up, I just wanted to put one thing to you, is whenever we cover slavery or the slave trade, we will inevitably get a few letters and comments from people who argue that there's too much focus given to the European slavers in this horrific story and overlooking the African involvement and Africans' involvement in enslaving people. And the Clotilda story, as you've described, does have an element of African people capturing other Africans. What's your take on that argument, on that contention?
Yeah, so of course, I mean, we shouldn't sideline the horrors of it on both sides of the Atlantic. There was slavery before the Europeans arrived in West Africa, but African slavery wasn't like chattel slavery. So African slavery was, if you're you could bond yourself out to pay off a debt. You could, okay, you might be captured in warfare too, but you could work as a, even if you're enslaved, you could be a soldier or an administrator, and your status wasn't passed down to your children. What happens when Europeans arrive is that the emergence of the sugar industry, which is intensively farmed crop, but incredibly profitable crop as well, leads to the emergence of chattel slavery. And chattel slavery is all about, as we've seen with what the Clotilda survivors endured, it's about shipping people across the Atlantic, stripping them of their identities, working them to death in many cases, because this, a lot of middle passage survivors lived only a few years in the Americas. And of course, this is about the racialization of people to justify their enslavement. So slavery can be passed on to the children. And so this sort of eternal enslavement, if you like, is very different from what happens in Africa. I mean, of course, you have the involvement of people like, you know, King Lele of Dahomey. But the arrival of Europeans creates demographic breakdown and social instability, which leads to the creation of these military states that are dependent on warfare rather than agriculture to sustain themselves. and also sort of forced to sell other people to protect against their own people's enslavement, transatlantic enslavement. So it's a race to the bottom, really. It's a horrible situation that doesn't justify selling a two-year-old child like Matilda McCrea across the Atlantic. But certainly West African societies are really put in an awful situation by the transatlantic slave trade.
Okay, and then some people, curiously, have denied the whole Clotilda story and considered it a hoax. What's going on there?
Yeah, so because no one was ever prosecuted, people were indicted, but, you know, the cases were quickly dropped. For a long time, the Wanderer was thought to be the last U.S. slave ship. Now, the Wanderer docked off the coast of Georgia in November 1858, so about 19 months before the Clotilda's landing. And the Wanderer conspirators were brought to trial, but they were acquitted. So it becomes widely seen as being the last U.S. slave ship in the history books, even well into the 21st century, actually. So only really with a couple of scholarly works that were published in 2007, 2008, that the Clotilda is taken seriously at all as an actual event. But I was even finding, I mean, I've been working on the Clotilda story for more than a decade now. And even when I was first presenting research on the Clotilda, I was hearing that people were dismissing, not coming to my presentations, but saying, oh, that's a hoax. So it's only really with, I mean, I published research on Radoshi, the Clotilda survivor Radoshi, that got a lot of international attention in 2019. And then about 6 weeks after I published that research, the Clotilda was located in the Mobile River. And that really sort of established, I think, that history couldn't be denied anymore. Descendants have worked hard to preserve and to promote their ancestors' stories. So it really is quite sad that it has taken this long for them to get this kind of mainstream attention. And even now, I think, you know, the attention blows hot and cold. You know, there'll be interest in Africa Town, and then obviously the media steps away and it's quiet again. But, you know, there's a tourism centre in Africa Town now, so hopefully that's bringing much more interest to the community.
But the Clotilda, that is definitively the last ship that brings enslaved people to continental America in the African slave trade.
So that arrives in the US, as far as we can tell, but the Cuban trade continues.
Yeah, just tell us a little bit about that, because it's not the end of the story, is it, tragically?
So Cuban slavery is abolished in 1886, and Brazilian slavery is abolished in 1888. But, I mean, I was finding, even when I was writing my book, that 1867 is generally accepted as the end of the transatlantic slave trade. But there is first-hand accounts suggesting that barracoons still in Ouida, which is where the Clotilda survivors were shipped from, well into the 1870s. And in fact, there was a Cuban woman claimed that she was trafficked in 1878 to Cuba from West Africa, from Ouida, I think. So this is something that continues for years after the Clotilda survivors arrive in the United States.
I wonder, having spent a lot of time researching, whether there was one thing that particularly sort of jolted you or made you think, crikey, that is such a surprising element that we need to know about it.
Yeah, so one thing that struck me as I was after I'd sort of agreed to write the book and as I was doing a bit more research into the story, was finding out that a Clotilda survivor named Bujan Moore was travelling into the heart of Montgomery up until 1925, selling wares that she foraged around her hometown. So again, we're back in the sort of the heart of the Confederacy. But also, this is kind of a key space in the civil rights movement. And at least three of the Clotilda survivors were very closely associated geographically with the civil rights movement. So Bujan Moore selling her wares just where Rosa Parks would very soon get on a bus, sparking the Montgomery bus boycotts. Matilda McCrea marches to Dallas County Courthouse in Selma demanding reparations, essentially, in 1931. And then 3 decades later, this is the Dallas County Courthouse, is exactly where Selma voting rights campaigners are marching, which will eventually lead to the passing of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And Radoshi is also friends with Amelia Boynton Robinson, who is a key figure in that voting rights campaign. So I was just struck by the close temporal and geographical proximity between the Clotilda survivors and the civil rights movement. That was really shocking.
That was Dr. Hannah Durkin. Her book on this subject is Survivors, A History of the Last Captives of the Atlantic Slave Trade. You can read much more about the Atlantic Slave Trade and slavery in general on the History Extra website. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.